they've adopted a new paradigm of pre-criminal investigation, where they have begun collecting everything on all of us. And they say that they're not going to, you know, read your email, for example, but they can. And if they did, you would never know.
Edward Snowden blew the whistle on the secret surveillance techniques used by our intelligence agencies. And he had some advice for the UK.
You need to impose a structure of oversight that will allow both members of government and the public to verify that their activities are proper and appropriate at all times, and that those who violate them can be held to account.
This week, in whatever is the opposite of a blaze of publicity, a bill aimed at doing just that became law. So tonight, in the briefing room, is the new Investigatory Powers Act a license to snoop, or does it protect our privacy against state surveillance? Joining me in the briefing room this week are three experts on intelligence gathering and surveillance law, coming from three different perspectives. They're David Anderson QC, the UK's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, Bella Sankey, policy director from the human rights advocacy group Liberty, and Sir David Omond, visiting professor at King's College London and a former director of the British intelligence agency GCHQ. Bella Sankey, in a nutshell, why is Liberty and other campaigners as well, and members of the public indeed, so outraged by this law?
The first thing to say is that we campaigned for a new piece of surveillance legislation. In the digital age, there are many challenges to our rights and freedoms, but sadly, this bill didn't grapple with any of that and instead focused almost exclusively on the extent to which the authorities should be able to exploit new technologies to conduct surveillance on a scale and a level of intrusiveness that would have been unimaginable 10, 15 years ago. The distinction between the online and the real world is porous, and if you don't have protections for freedom of speech, for privacy, for activism, then you very quickly lose your offline rights as well.
Now, some people have said that Britain, through this, becomes like Stasi in East Germany, a big brother state and so on. Do you think that's justified criticism, or is that over the top?
Comparisons with older regimes where total surveillance was the ambition and to a certain extent realised are potentially unhelpful, but the capabilities that now exist would have been Stasi Germany's ambition, but not something they thought could ever have been realised.
OK, that's the broadness of the critique. Let's try and understand the detail. David Anderson, you're the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation for the United Kingdom. What does that job actually mean? What do you do?
Well, I'm an independent person, taken off the street or out of the temple where the barristers practice. I'm allowed to read the secrets and speak to the secret people, and I report to Parliament and the public on how our terrorism laws are being operated.
Are you our person in there, or are you their person with us?
Very much your person with them.
OK, now the Investigatory Powers Act essentially came about because of recommendations made by you. So what's the story behind it?
Well, there were a number of reports commissioned by government to look into the whole area of investigatory powers. It's partly that, as Bella says, the old law was out of date. I said it wasn't fit for purpose. It's partly because Edward Snowden's revelations demonstrated to the public at large that a lot of powers were being used, which people didn't really know about. Even Parliament didn't really know about. Lawyers started taking Snowden's material to the courts and saying, we weren't warned about this, it doesn't seem to be provided for very clearly in law, and the courts had begun to respond to those cases. There were cases, for example, about the use of equipment interference, which is basically hacking or the implantation of malware into computers, phones and other devices by the government. And that's not something that the government had ever admitted in terms that it did. Most other governments still don't admit that they do it. And what the court said was that until the government rushed out a code of practice in which they had finally acknowledged that this is what they were doing in an attempt to keep us all safe, the power had actually been unlawfully exercised.
Now, what did you recommend? I mean, what are the absolute key changes in the law?
The Act really does three things. First of all, it sets out in one clear law all the powers that public authorities, particularly police and intelligence agencies, already exercise under 65 different laws to intercept phones, to hack into equipment, and to gather details about people's communications, so that those powers, some of which are very extensive, can be exercised not on the basis of vague rules, which were only ever understood within the secret state, but on the basis of laws carefully considered by Parliament. Then the second thing it does is strengthen the safeguards on those powers, in particular bringing the judges in to authorising warrants to intercept people's phones. Now, they went round this course 30, 40 years ago in the US and in Canada. You know, they found in the 70s the CIA were intercepting Martin Luther King and his associates. They were trying to break up his marriage. They were spying on the women's liberation movement. And when there was a big series of reports on all this, the consensus was you can't trust government just to do this on their own. You've got to bring in the judges as well. That's what they did in the US, and that's finally what we're doing as well in the UK.
So what kind of activity would need both now the permission of a judge and the Home Secretary, where previously it wouldn't?
Whenever you're intercepting the content of somebody's calls, so if you think there might be a drug dealer or an organised crime ring in an English town and you want to put a tap on some phones in order to see what's going on, that would need the approval of a judge as well as currently of the Home Secretary. But beyond that, there are the bulk powers where it is possible to intercept a large number of people's communications at the same time, and those warrants as well, which currently have been simply authorised by the Home Secretary or the Foreign Secretary, will need to be approved by a senior judge.
Can I just talk about that, so we're clear about what bulk powers actually mean?
Bulk powers are defined by the collection of material relating to people, not all of whom are suspicious. They're mostly useful, actually, not for the content of the communications. They're more useful for the patterns that you can find from the way that people communicate with each other. You might be able to identify or to develop your knowledge of a terrorist or a terrorist cell, and you might be able to respond, for example, to a kidnap situation or to support armed forces in time of war.
One presumes the bulk data was being collected before, that it was being collected in an unregulated or underregulated or even illegal way.
The laws were there, but it wasn't generally understood what the law meant. My view was that it had to be much more precise.
And you think this has been achieved now?
Absolutely. And I heard one complaint when the bill came out that it mentions the word bulk 400 times. Well, in my book, that is better than the previous law, which didn't mention the word bulk once, despite the fact that bulk interception was going on under the previous law.
There's another controversial change brought in by the Investigatory Powers Act, which is the power for the police and other public bodies to view our internet browsing histories. Now, there's been a big list, which has been published by a lot of newspapers, it's been circulated on social media a lot too, of all the people who can do this. I've got it here, it's the police, the HMRC, the Food Standards Agency, the Gambling Commission, and so on. They say can all get access to our internet browsing histories. Is that broadly true?
Yes, I mean, these are all organisations that are entrusted with enforcement of the law, and it's been decided that this new power, and it really is a new power, should be made available to them, of course, on certain conditions and with certain safeguards.
Now, how specific is this information going to be? I mean, people have a kind of picture of, on permission, people being able to see literally everything that they search for. So what would people be able to see, and is it actually properly defined?
Well, the obligation is to keep for, I think, up to a year records of our internet activity. That doesn't mean the contents of anything we've been putting on the internet, nor does it mean even the specific page that we're on, but it does mean the sites that we've been visiting. And the purpose of this is said to be that it's useful sometimes for identifying the sender of a communication. It's useful for identifying the communication services a person is using. So in the old days, they might have telephoned each other if they'd been up to no good. Maybe now they've Skyped each other and you need to know they were both on Skype at the same time.
And what are the safeguards that you have built in for all of us in the Act?
Well, this wasn't a recommendation of mine. When I looked at this idea, I said that the operational case simply hadn't been made and the police hadn't got their act together. So in the circumstances, I said it was up to them to try and do that if they wanted a power in the bill. They subsequently got their act together. They persuaded the government and eventually Parliament that the power was a good idea.
I'm going to move on now to you, Sir David Omond. Because you were director of GCHQ, the listening arm of the British Intelligence Services, to talk about whether or not the powers, that is, rather than the oversight in the Act, are really necessary, or whether they are over the top, as critics suggest. Do you think that bulk interception, in the way it's laid out in the Act, is an absolutely essential part of a modern security services
armoury?
The short answer is yes, I do. But there's a prior question, which is, what is the point of all this? Out there, there are people who mean us harm. Now, the argument is that it has been proven over many years now that having information about those people, their whereabouts, their activities, their communications, their associates, stops attacks. In the last 18 months, the security service and the police have stopped 7 or maybe 8 attempts to attack this country. Now, against that background, you then have to say, how do the police and the intelligence agencies go about finding out enough about the individuals who mean us harm? One of the ways is through what's called digital intelligence, either about content or about who called whom, when and where and how, or by very specifically placing, for example, computer programs that get the terrorist's machine to speak to you covertly, so you will know the content of what is being transmitted.
So that's malware.
That's malware. The term in the Act is equipment interference, because there are various ways in which it can be done. Now, you were asking about bulk powers. The most important one is the bulk acquisition of communications data, large amounts of data about who caught whom, when, where, and how. That is one of the primary investigative tools, both of the police and of the security service.
Can you give us an example, David, of what such an investigation might be?
Suppose you had a terrorist in Raqqa in Syria, somebody who'd gone to fight for the so-called Islamic State, and they are in contact with somebody in the United Kingdom. And by various means, the authorities have established there is a communication. What you then want to know is, who is that person in the United Kingdom themselves contacted? Is this an isolated call? Is this the beginning of a network? Almost certainly you won't be able to hear the content of the call, because it will almost certainly these days be encrypted, thanks in part to Mr. Snowden. But what you will be able to do is establish a pattern of who called whom.
And it targets people both here and abroad.
Yes.
What do you think, from your experience, of a new system which requires a judge in addition to sign off on warrants? I mean, it does introduce one very big extra level of complexity.
It does. I changed my mind on this a couple of years ago when I was a member of an independent panel that looked at all this before the legislation was put together. And having heard the arguments from the civil liberties side, I came to the conclusion that rather than just tinker with the current legislation, that actually it would be better to start again and write something which was for the 21st century. I would not underestimate, and I hope listeners won't underestimate, how seismic a shift this is. This is the end of a 500-year journey to turn the secret part of the British state into a set of organisations that operate under the rule of law. The government did not, in the past, admit to some of these activities, although they were actually lawfully warranted and signed off. Nonetheless, you would not have known that as a member of the public.
David Owen, thank you very much indeed. And I just want to very quickly kind of sum up where we've got to before we now take the discussion on. The Investigatory Powers Act is going to compel internet service providers to store our internet browsing histories for 12 months, though that info will only reveal what sites we visited, not the specific pages within those sites or what we bought online and so on. And a big development is when it comes to more serious surveillance, where in the past this could be signed off by the Home Secretary. Such warrants will now have to be signed off both by the Home Secretary and a senior judge. Bella Sankey, Policy Director from Liberty. As we've heard, you've been very critical of the Investigatory Powers Act. Let's just mark the point about judicial oversight. You're in favour of that, I presume, in that it gives public more protection against abuse of surveillance laws than we've ever had before. I mean, it's something you've aimed for.
We've been campaigning for judicial oversight and judicial warrantry for surveillance requests for almost our entire history as an organisation. It's an anomaly in our system, really. If you think about a basic search warrant, the police have to go to a magistrate to get sign-off before they can enter your house and search for things. In the modern age, we have almost just as much on our phones and on our laptops, on our desktops, as we do in our house in terms of data on us, information that is revealing and intrusive. And so as a sort of basic democratic safeguard, of course, the independent judiciary need to be able to sanction or otherwise intrusion of this level. So it's a welcome step forward. The actual terms of judicial involvement that the bill sets out are actually pretty limited. So warrants are still going to be issued by the Secretary of State, the Home Secretary, or by chief constables. And it's not judges that issue warrants. Judges can then have a kind of second look at the decision that's already been taken by either a minister or a chief constable.
Is it not the case, however, that the judge still has to agree before the thing can happen?
The judge has to agree that the decision that has been made by somebody else is not unreasonable.
But it was always going to be that way around, wasn't it? I mean, the judge was never going to initiate the decision themselves.
Well, actually, the recommendation made by David Anderson and the practice elsewhere in the world is that judges authorise a warrant. So the person seeking the warrant, whether it's the police or the intelligence agencies, need to present to a judge a case as to why a warrant is necessary. And a judge looks at the merits of that case and decides whether or not to grant it. Our system is not going to work like that.
So does that worry amount to a fear that judges will all too easily sign off on things that they shouldn't because they haven't been integrally involved in the reasoning for the decision in the first place? Is that broadly right?
Yes. And the other problem with the model set out in the bill is that if a judge does say that they don't think a warrant is justified or that the decision is right, the person applying for the warrant can then go to another judicial commissioner, effectively. The Home Secretary or the Chief Constable gets to just go and have another opinion.
David,
well, if the judges are going to be as supine as Bella suggests, then we've got a problem. I don't believe for a moment that that is the case. The judges are asked to decide for themselves whether the decision to authorise a warrant is proportionate, and they have the power to block a warrant if they don't think it should be coming into force.
Now, another point which has really captured the public's attention is this ability for authorities to access our internet browsing history. Isn't that just sort of keeping up with the times?
This doesn't represent keeping up with the times. This goes a great step further than that, really. This is not a practice that any other European country has adopted and kept with. And indeed, on the one occasion where it was trialled in Denmark, they abandoned the scheme because it didn't actually result in helpful information that was useful for criminal investigations. We don't need to keep the web browsing habits of the entire population on record for a year. That is an incredibly disproportionate response to the very real need to employ targeted surveillance methods against, as David Amann says, those people that wish us harm.
Now, you've used the word proportionate, which is really quite important here, that the amount of benefit you might conceivably get in security terms from such a process is outweighed by the amount of intrusiveness that you would undertake into the lives of ordinary people.
The level of intrusion is extreme, and when combined with the powers that already exist, what you've essentially created is the power or the requirement that at the end of each day someone files with the government a record of not only all of the websites that they've looked at that day, which can be very revealing, but all records of who they've spoken to, at what time, where they were, the streets that they've walked, the locations that they visited. All of this data taken together provides a blueprint into somebody's soul, essentially. It is a kind of level of intrusion that has not properly, I don't think, been made clear by government.
What about the oversight arrangements for this particular part of the Act?
This particular part of the Act has very little in the way of oversight or accountability. So unlike powers to hack and intercept, there is no requirement for any judicial or independent oversight of this power.
So this one doesn't have to go to a judge?
No. The police and the other authorities, which, as you've already cited, are everyone from the Food Standards Agency to the Department for Work and Pensions, can self-authorise their access to this data.
David Diamond.
We're at risk of confusing here what we mean by oversight. There is prior authorisation, which in the case of internet connection records will not involve the full warranting and judges. That's absolutely right. But then you have oversight by the Judicial Commissioner and the inspectors who work for the Judicial Commissioner of ex post afterwards. How has all this been used? How many requests? It would be a mistake to say there isn't oversight.
I think Bella hits the point exactly when she points to the amazing things that the police and intelligence agencies can do with our data, as indeed Google and Amazon and others can do with our data. And it seems to me you can react in one of two ways. You can either say, oh, this is terrible, let's stop them from doing it, and let's withdraw from this activity, which we know all our competitors are liable to be doing, we know our enemies in the world are liable to be doing. Or we can say, well, let's accept that the technology exists, let's allow it to be used, and let's make sure the safeguards are so strong that we have a pretty good assurance that they're going to be used properly.
OK, that seems to me a very fair summary of what the listener can weigh up. Bella Sankey, let's turn to bulk collection of data and your view of that.
The powers contained in the bill are, of course, essential in investigating serious crime and preventing other, essentially, human rights abuses. So there is no argument at all with the powers. The problem with bulk powers and many of the ways in which passages of this piece of legislation is drafted is the scale of the surveillance permitted and the lack of effective checks and balances to ensure that surveillance is conducted in a targeted and proportionate way. So to take bulk acquisition of communications data currently and in future under this Act, the security agencies are able to acquire communications data on the entire population every single day, always. And that's their starting point. Instead of starting with targets and working outwards and looking at their networks and trying to spot patterns and work in an intelligence-led way, this Act turns surveillance and investigation really on its head and starts with everybody. Any surveillance system which is taking in billions of communications, processing that data on a daily basis, I think equates to a system of mass surveillance.
That's,
I don't know how...
We disagree, because that is not my definition of mass surveillance. It's persistent observation of either the whole or a very large part of the population.
But this surveillance is persistent. It's daily. It's looking at our records every single day population.
With respect, that is nonsense. I mean, if we believe that our intelligence agencies are evil people who are out to do us all harm, then of course we shouldn't give them powers of this nature.
Of course we don't believe that, David.
They're not interested in reading our emails. They don't, most of them, have time to read their own emails. What they are doing is they are looking for serious crime. Those are the only purposes for which they can use these powers. And you don't always start with the target. Sometimes you have to work out who the target is.
I mean, Bella Sankey, of course, in looking through all those records, you had to be able to see them in order to see the ones that you actually wanted, but that didn't mean you were surveilling everybody else.
The situations that have been described are ones which relate to specific criminal investigations, where you are starting with something akin to a target. The problem with this legislation is it doesn't limit itself to those sorts of situations at all, but rather allows for much more speculative trawling of the sort that I've described, where you are filleting through billions and billions of communications and you don't necessarily need any sort of lead or target or causal nexus.
But it's not lawful just to browse through everybody's communications. It's absolutely unlawful. You need a national security purpose or a serious crime purpose.
But those can be so broad,
and
David. As you said so rightly, David, when you published your original report, these powers should not be given or taken purely on trust. We know from very recent experience here in the UK that abuses do happen. Doreen Lawrence was put under surveillance by the Metropolitan Police. Environmental activists were subjected to the most horrendous surveillance practices by undercover officers. If you don't have very clear safeguards in legislation that limit powers, abuses
take place.
That's
exactly what we now have. And the point is not just who authorises the operation. It's the fact that you have these very senior judges, well equipped with technical experts, who will go in after the event and check that the powers were properly exercised.
Okay.
And every intelligence official and every police officer knows that.
I want to move to a conclusion. Bella, while you're critical of the Investigatory Powers Act, when you look at it in the round, I mean, you look back on this period and so on, do you think there's a chance that you'll say, you know, we were critical, but actually this Act left us in a better place than we were before. And actually, we at Liberty should be rather satisfied with our role in it.
There have certainly been steps forward. We've talked about judicial involvement in warrantry, which is a major development. But of course, there's further to go. I think there has been such a sea change as a result of this legislation in terms of the awesome power that the authorities, not just the intelligence agencies, but many other public bodies now have, and such a dilution of the power balance between the individual and the state, that this certainly needs a second look, and that will most likely happen now in the courts.
Dave Danson, do you think that now the UK is more open than other governments when it comes to the activities of our intelligence agencies, or do we still have some way to go?
I think this act is world-leading in terms of transparency. And I think the central point here is that good surveillance deters crime and it deters terrorism. We've heard only this week the so-called man with a hat, one of the Belgian terror suspects. He's been giving evidence to an English jury saying, well, we weren't planning anything against England because we heard your surveillance was good. And I think it's because good surveillance is able to keep us safe that it makes us less likely to have to resort to actually much more intrusive and unfortunate measures of the sort that they've got, for example, in France under the state of emergency. So you have house arrest, you have curfews, you have unwarranted searches. So I think before one tries to diminish these very important powers, one needs to think about what the alternative might be.
David Omond, at the end of all this process, do you think that we are left safer or less safe as a consequence of the provision of an act like this?
I think we're safer, and what is now being done in our name by the secret agencies is being done under the rule of law. I would much rather Liberty accepted a pat on the back for having nudged government into taking this stand, which probably would have happened at some time in the future, but it certainly happened earlier because of the activity they've taken. Wasting everyone's time by going to the European Court of Human Rights, just accept it, try it. We will get reports from the judicial commissioners, senior judges who will be appointed to this role. These will be public reports. We can judge, and Parliament can judge.
Bella Sankey, you get the last word.
It's very nice to have a pat on the back from you, David Omond, but we are a country that believes in the rule of law. As a result of that, we will exercise our rights and, as I say, look to the judges to ensure that our laws comply with the best international standards.
OK, well, that's the argument. The Act actually is an Act, so the question now is how it is enacted and what concretely results from it. My very big thanks to my guests, the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, David Anderson, QC, Bella Sankey, policy director from Liberty, and to David Omond, visiting professor at King's College London and former director of GCHQ. The Briefing Room will return at the same time next week. Goodbye.